This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. When it comes to economics, whether you're Christian, Hindu, or Muslim, it's not culture that's destiny, says Harvard development guru Jeffrey Sachs. It's geography that rules. The Islamic world's economy may be down, he says, but don't count it out. In this hour, the Islamic economy racing against time. But first, the Palestinian Authority investigates claims that its officials were involved with smuggling 50 tons of Iranian-made weapons into the Gaza Strip. Lauren Freyer is a correspondent for the Associated Press in Jerusalem. I asked her about the story behind the weapons seizure last Thursday and how it's playing out politically and militarily.
Well, Israel's making a lot of accusations. The Israeli prime minister has been talking about this every day in speeches here and there. One of the things that he's worried about is a connection between Iran and the Palestinians. A lot of the weapons were Iranian-made, and the containers that they were in, these plastic containers that were set to float at just about any depth in the water, were only made in Iran. And so there's a definite Iran link here. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says he's really worried about Iran being the center of world terror, he says. Both Iran and the Palestinians, however, deny any involvement with this weapons shipment, but a senior Israeli military official says that Iran sold the weapons to the Palestinians for just about $10 million, which is way below their actual worth. And so there's some speculation that the Palestinians and Iran are working on this together against Israel.
Is there a history of Iran supplying weapons on this scale to any Palestinian groups?
Iran has supplied weapons to Hezbollah, Islamic group of Lebanese guerrillas, and they have in past years fought alongside Palestinians. As far as I know, that there's no previous link of Iran directly giving weapons to the Palestinians.
If the rockets and anti-tank missiles would have made it into Palestinian hands, how might that have changed the balance of the conflict in Israel and the West Bank, Gaza?
Well, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says it would have drastically, completely turned the Mideast security situation upside down. The load contained 62 Katyusha rockets. Now, these are rockets that would have been capable of hitting just about any Israeli city from anywhere in the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinian territories. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says it put the lives of just about every Israeli citizen in danger. It's also a deterrent. The Palestinians, if they were as armed as Israel is, would be in a much different bargaining situation in the Mideast conflict.
And how is this playing out politically inside Israel? What's public opinion in response to the seizure, and what political consequences?
Israel has made a really big deal about this. Israeli Prime Minister went on national television and had this conference from Eilat in the south of Israel where the boat is now being held. He stood in front of a table of all of these weapons and called Yasser Arafat a bitter enemy of Israel. He's holding Yasser Arafat responsible. He says that a weapons shipment of this magnitude, of this size, could never have come into Palestinian territory without the knowledge of the chairman of the Palestinian Authority, and that's Yasser Arafat. So it's definitely heightened the political situation here. Also, the past couple days was the visit of U.S. peace envoy Anthony Zinni. Now, he was here for 4 days, and he left on Monday. His mission was just completely overshadowed by this whole row.
And what about the Palestinian response? What has Yasser Arafat had to say?
Well, Arafat's denying any knowledge and any involvement. However, the captain of the boat, who is Palestinian, and the Palestinians are admitting that he was Palestinian, he's in jail, and he's come out and said that he was taking orders from the Palestinian leadership. Now, the captain doesn't say he knows definitively that Arafat knew about his mission, but he says he took orders from one of Arafat's close advisors. But the Palestinians are keeping relatively quiet here, and they're saying that Israel is trying to incite the conflict once again, and they're saying that Israel's sabotaging the Palestinians in hopes that they can crack down further on this Palestinian violence that's been going on since September 2000.
Sabotaging in what sense? Are they saying that the weapons were a plant of some kind?
And I'm not sure that they're going as far to say that the weapons were planted, but the Palestinian Information Minister, Yasser Abed Rabo, says that Israel's not letting a third party in on the investigation of this arms shipment, and he's calling for the U.S. and the European Union, the U.N., and even Russia to come in and act as a third party here to monitor this investigation. Now, he's accusing Israel of not letting that happen, and so the Palestinians say they don't know anything about it, but they're going to investigate it on their own. they claim that Arafat and the Palestinian leadership knew nothing about this.
Washington's been fairly low-key. They said today that they found the Israeli claims credible. What has the response been that Israelis have seen from the U.S.?
Well, Israel has not seen the reaction from the U.S. that it has wanted. The Israeli transportation minister has made accusations that the U.S. knows that this boat is allegedly a Palestinian boat and the mission was run by the Palestinians, but that the U.S. is deliberately not accusing the Palestinians of this in hopes that they can restrain Israel's reaction. So Israel says that the U.S. has a big hand in the intelligence in the region and knows for sure that this is a Palestinian boat, but is deliberately keeping that information and not making a public statement about it. Now, the U.S. raised the possibility that the boat may be carrying weapons to Hezbollah in Lebanon, mm-hmm. militant group there, but Israel discredits these reports and says there would be no reason to smuggle weapons into Lebanon by water in such a secret manner as to have these floating containers to drop off the Gaza coast. They could simply just smuggle the weapons through Syria over land.
Is there a sense that the U.S. might not want to get into a conflict with Iran right now, given that Iran's been kind of a silent partner in the Afghan effort?
Now, the U.S. hasn't said anything publicly about Iran being partner to this arms shipment, but the Iranian foreign minister is denying any involvement, and the U.S. is basically keeping its options open and being relatively quiet, mentioning the Hezbollah possibility, but not saying anything beyond that.
Lauren Freyer is a correspondent for the Associated Press. She spoke to me from Jerusalem. Can Islam and economic development coexist, even prosper, in the Middle East and North Africa? After 200 years of hard times, it's tempting to see Islamic culture as an economic bust. Not so fast, warns tonight's guest, Jeffrey Sachs. There's more than burqas and bad politics at work here. There's hard geography, hard history, and mercifully, a chance to succeed. What do you think needs to be done to bring impoverished Islamic countries into the 21st century economy? What should the role of the United States be? And can development come fast enough to defuse a demographic time bomb? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the International Development Center and professor of international trade at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Sachs.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Also joining us tonight is special guest news analyst Jyoti Puri, assistant professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Boston. Jyoti, it's great to have you tonight.
Hi, Tom. Good evening.
So, Jeffrey Sachs, we have all watched this great drama that's unfolded over the last months, and maybe longer than that. And we look out at the Middle East and North Africa, where this terrorism emerged from, and one can only imagine that the economic circumstances there might well breed anger and resentment and even terror itself, and we'd all like that to be better. But at the same time, the image that we get, and maybe that we're conditioned to see, is of a culture that doesn't look like a great candidate for economic development. You say that there's a tendency to cast economic trends in moral and theological terms. Is that going on right now as the West looks at the Middle East?
Tom, Islam, of course, has about 1.5 billion adherents stretched out over 10,000 miles. And the variety of economic experience and performance, economic growth, poverty and riches is really vast.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first simple thing to say is there have been a number of Islamic countries that have done quite well economically over the last 30 years.
An Malaysia, example of Indonesia that would, for a while.
Exactly, the Southeast Asian countries. Mm-hmm. And on the whole, even with the recent stumbling in both places, the 30 or 40-year pattern is a tremendous amount of economic progress. If you look closer to Europe, a country like Tunisia right now, mm-hmm. which is an Islamic country, of course, just on the southern edge of the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. has had good economic growth because it has been integrating the economy with the European Union. And in fact, in a kind of free trade area, so that a lot of investment is pouring into that country.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing to say is there's a big variety of experience. There are many different kinds of economies mm-hmm. At stake.
But when we look at that Islamic heartland right there in the Middle East and much of the North Africa, if you peel away the oil, there's not a lot else going on. Why is that?
Of course, again, if you look at Turkey or Morocco or Tunisia or even Egypt in recent years, it's not too bad, though there's a lot of problems and crisis. There has been a lot of economic growth. If you look in the Arabian Peninsula at Saudi, which is basically an oil state, then it goes up and down like a yo-yo with the world oil prices. It hasn't developed a lot of other industry. A place like Yemen in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula is tremendously backward. And then the fascinating whole stretch of places that we're dealing with and getting to know right now too fast, the so-called stands of Central Asia, not just Afghanistan, but Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and so forth, they all face an incredibly tough problem of being landlocked, generally mountainous states, really far from the major centers of the world economy. Also, typically desert or dry places, so that even agriculture is tough. So you have peasant communities, relatively isolated from the world markets, often herdsmen, shepherds, and so forth, what we know about Afghanistan. And that's a very, very tough road to follow for economic development.
But Jeff Sachs, I want to look at this in just as big a terms as you've written about it. And that is, if you go back 1,000 years or more, you can see Islam overshadowing Christendom, if you will, and Europe and the West economically. And now at the very highest level, that has really been reversed. And there is a tendency now to look out and see Islam, despite the nuance and variety that you describe, to look at the indicators, look at the countries, and say there's a cultural problem here. You say that's the wrong way to look at it. Open that up for us.
There is, of course, a great theme of history. You know, we have several great themes, but one of the great themes of history is the competition between Christendom and the Islamic world, which has lasted for more than 1,000 years. And I think it's fair to say, in fact, inevitable to say, that has been a real competition marked by war, change of borders.
It's not just theoretical.
That's right. The conquest of Spain, the reconquest by the Christians, the shrinking of the Ottoman Empire, and so forth. Now, that whole story of the Islamic expansion in the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, and then the Islamic contraction after the 16th century is generally told as a case where you had a dynamic culture for a while, but then something went wrong, it lost its dynamism, and the decline of Islam is told as a morality story, that this was a fatal flaw of society that led to the collapse of what had been a dynamic society. I tried to take a look at that in research in the last couple of years, and my conclusion is really something different, which is that the Islamic world did have a big expansion. It had a big expansion when Europe was extremely weak, when trade routes went right through those Central Asian
countries. The crossroads of the world, the camel caravans all came through.
When the Silk Road, rather than the ocean trade, was the dominant factor, then Islam was in the expansion. But what I found was that the simple geographical fact of living in a desert, dry region, meaning the populations in the Islamic world did not increase for almost 1,000 years, while Europe was developing and booming, meant that the Islamic states and eventually the Ottoman Empire couldn't even hold their own territory. They started losing war after war after war, and as they lost the trade routes, that led to a cascading shrinkage of their economic space.
Jeff Sachs, we're going to investigate more of that after the break, but before we go there, Jody Puri, you see the picture that Jeff Sachs is laying out, big sweep of history. It doesn't come to a very nice place for the Islamic world right now, generally, economically. Geography behind all this?
I think what's interesting and compelling about Professor Sachs's comments is that he's drawing our attention to a number of different things, including geography, some role of culture, history. And I think there's some real merit in drawing a complicated picture to a complicated set of issues, given the variety, I think, as you just pointed out. The one thing I think it also sort of raises for me is, you know, what about in terms of, can we get to some specifics here in terms of what is this going to entail?
To pull the Islamic world out of
the
economic slump that much of it is in. We're going to take a short break and we'll talk about the history, about geography, culture, and how the Islamic world might pull up out of this dive. What do you think? Is the Islamic economy weighed down by its own culture? Jeffrey Sachs says no. Do you buy it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
from Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're joined tonight by Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Center for International Development at Harvard University, and we're looking at the Islamic economy. If it doesn't come back, if it doesn't improve, we're going to have a lot more problems. There's a big population explosion awaiting in the Middle East. There's a water shortage. This part of the world is not going to be happy, not going to be a good global neighbor if it doesn't have better economic future ahead of it. But is the main issue here culture, or is it geography? Is it environment? That's what we're looking at tonight. What do you think? Can the West, can the United States play a helpful, meaningful role, giving the political sword tips that we've been at with this region in pulling it up? Would you bet your 401k on economic revival in the Mideast? We're also joined tonight by Jyoti Puri. She's assistant professor at Simmons College, and she's here tonight as our guest news analyst. Jeffrey Sachs, when I was in grade school, in our official school psalm book, there was a song, and the lyrics of it went like this. It was about, it had a little Turkish man with curled up slippers dancing around, and it said, I remember the lyrics perfectly. It said, Ashim was a tootin' Turk. All day long he'd toot, not work. And you can hear the deep cultural bias in there, a kind of a Eurocentric view of this Turkish man saying, this guy doesn't work economically. Where did that come from?
It's interesting that another cultural symbol in the town square of Prague is the Orolog from about 5 centuries ago, the famous clock where the puppets move.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the puppets there is a Turk, but it's a Turk not as a figure of laughter or mirth, but a Turk as a warning. Because 500 years ago, Europe was feeling at the edge of disaster of Turkish invasion. The Ottoman Empire was anything but mirthful, anything but a lazy joke. It was viewed as the greatest threat to Europe.
It was a powerhouse.
It was an absolute powerhouse.
And you point out 1683, they come to the siege of Vienna, they fail in that siege, and it was downhill from there. What did that mean economically?
Of course, what it meant economically as Europe rolled the Ottoman Empire back to its core was the loss of the economic advantages of trade routes, resources, and the incredible cost that the Islamic world paid in losing wars century after century. But the real question is, why did they lose those wars? And one of the things that I found quite striking when I went back to what are the best guesses for what these places were like 1,000 years ago or 1,200 years ago is that around 800, when Charlemagne became king, if we go way back, the European population was about 29 million, and the estimated population of the Middle East and North Africa was also 29 million, roughly parity. But fascinatingly, if you go century by century at the best guesses, by 1200, Europe had 58 million people, and the Middle East and North Africa still 29 million. If you go to 1600, Europe is now 3 times more populous than the Middle East. And if you go to 1900, Europe has about 390 million, and the Middle East still 56 million. So, now, I ask myself, why?
Yeah.
Generally, in history, the populations depended on the capacity to grow food or on the natural resources. And most of Islam, especially North Africa, the Middle East, and into Central Asia, is in the arid regions. And there just wasn't a big increase of food capacity or of the forests for a basic biomass. Fascinatingly, when Muhammad Ali, not the one we know, but the emperor of Egypt in the 1840s and 50s, tried to industrialize with a pretty coherent strategy, he attracted some factories that could use the new steam engines of the time. But there was no coal in Egypt. There was no coal to burn, so they went out of business because the cost of importing the coal from Northern Europe was prohibitively expensive.
So geography was tough. The deserts were arid. The soils weren't great. And as you say, then transport moved to the oceans, and we get the Industrial Revolution, and the Islamic world is, in general, not well positioned to take advantage of that. There's one more thing I want to touch on historically, because it comes back up in Osama bin Laden's comments and in a lot of the anger we see in the Middle East, and that is the sense that once they got on the ropes, Europe just pushed them right on down to the ground. What's that about?
Europe pushed a lot of places down on the ground because Europe industrialized first. It really got the power of the Industrial Revolution, so colonial rule came to lots of the world, including throughout North Africa, including the British occupation of Egypt in 1882, including the so-called League of Nations states after World War I, including the direct colonial rule throughout the Middle East by the British and the French during the interwar period. So there was tremendous resentment, of course, of actually losing one's sovereignty. And that leaves a bitter residue which lasts for a long time.
We're going to bring this up to the future. We're looking at the economies across the Islamic world and why so many of them are really not in a good situation. What part does culture play? What part does geography play? Jeffrey Sachs says geography plays a huge part. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Is culture destiny? Is it all about geography? Can the Middle East rise again? Jyoti Puri, here we're looking at this melange of geography and culture and ecology and some sharp-elbowed history in there as well. What do you see?
You know, I'm particularly interested where Jeff left us in terms of the recent history, especially with the role of imperialism. And again, going back to your comments about Osama bin Laden, I mean, I think it really raises the question about what has this last 100, 150 years meant for the contemporary crises. In some ways, you know, people have called for that. One way to rebuild is to open up these economies. Others would argue, in fact, that's the thing that has created the problem in the first place. So, you know, I wonder what you would, what kind of insight you would have on that.
In general, if you open up and you get invaded in the process, it's not very good. So
leaves a bad taste.
Exactly. And one of the things that happened when the colonial rule ended in India and in the Middle East was that the new state builders of a place like Egypt, when Nasser took over in the 1952 revolution, or when Nehru took over of the newly independent state of India, they said, we don't like the outside world very much, and we certainly don't want to invite multinational companies. They have abused us, even ruled us as companies for a couple of hundred years. Now, the sad part was that multinational investment without imperialism is actually necessary for development. But if you took the past history and said the future is going to be just like the past, we don't want foreign companies coming in, those countries turned out to cheat themselves because they cut themselves out from the world economy. Right now, most developing countries are trying to attract investment, not to repel investment. And some countries in the Islamic world, and I mentioned Tunisia as a case of some significance, taking advantage of its proximity to Europe is doing quite well. Turkey's doing reasonably well. But a big problem with attracting foreign investors is if you're really far away in the Himalayan foothills as Afghanistan, you can open the door, you can decide whatever, but no one's going to come. And so that becomes a big problem.
And of course, if the foreign investor starts out with the impression that they're not welcome and that culturally there's something here that they'll never get through, that's another huge impediment. We're talking about the economies of the Islamic world and how they might develop. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to bring this up to date and look forward, but I want to bring our callers into the conversation. There are many that want to join us. Dovi is on the line. Welcome, Dovi.
Yes, hi.
Hi,
hi, Professor.
Hi.
I think I subscribe to your argument about geography being a primary factor in the condition of the economies of many of these countries. I totally disagree with the host about lumping so many different countries under that vocable or that concept of Muslim or Islamic economy.
So the whole idea of economies of the Islamic world means you reject the cultural theme here, Dovi.
Yes, I mean, yes, I do. I do, because those situations are so different across the board, too diverse to be able to be lumped together as a one coherent group.
Well, we take your point, and Jeffrey Sachs, is right from the outset tonight, has set us straight that there's a tremendous diversity within the Islamic world economically. What's your view, Dovi? Do you think that means that culture's not playing a role here, or that there are many different cultures playing a role here?
I think, first of all, there are many different cultures, and I also think that the cultural aspect can be downplayed. I think that's where maybe there is a need for countries like the United States with a relatively clean hand in terms of colonial past to engage in another type of cultural dialogue with those countries. And maybe train these people to understand, and these countries to understand, what it means to have a market-based economy, or what it means to invite investors in. Mm. Does that mean loss of sovereignty, loss of self-identity, or is it a halfway between just opening up yourself to others or cooperating with others in achieving a common good?
Dovey, we got your point. I want to put it to Jeffrey Sachs, and maybe this is a good place to plunge into looking ahead. Jeffrey Sachs, Dovey says the U.S. has relatively clean hands, though, gee, we've got a lot that's happened just lately, and we should go in and help countries sort of get onto the market path. This is one of the things that you're saying prescriptively is the West needs to draw closer, needs to become more integrated with economies of the Islamic world. And secondly, that there needs to be a much greater investment in human capital there. What's needed and what are the prospects for it happening?
Well, I really appreciate Dovey's comments. And when I try to think about it, I try to think about specific regions. As I mentioned, there's the Mediterranean region. There's the Middle East and the Arabian Peninsula. There's Central Asia with all those problems and so forth. Each place, one has to think strategically. There are different issues involved. There are places where culture really does count right now, or maybe culture through the lens of politics. I'll give an example just to not go all the way the other way. In Saudi Arabia right now, the role of women is amazingly different, and I would say quite shocking, actually, compared to the role of women in economies at the similar level of per capita income. Women are not in the labor force. One can spend days in Riyadh literally not seeing a woman, actually, because they're supposed to stay home.
What are the economic consequences?
The economic consequences are amazing. Saudi Arabia is a country of around $10,000 per capita. Almost every country at that level of income around the world has women in the labor force to a large extent. And when women are in the labor force, they're usually having two children, perhaps maybe three. In Saudi Arabia, women are at home and they're having six or seven children. The so-called fertility rate or total fertility rate remains incredibly high for a country at that level. Now,
so does Saudi Arabia want U.S. advisors to come over and hustle those women out of their homes and into cashier jobs at Walmarts in Mecca?
Well, it's quite interesting. You know, what is actually happening there? One has to make an interpretation. At one level, it is culture, because the cultural claim is women should not be in the labor force, and every kind of proscription, legal and cultural, is applying there. And it leads to these outcomes, which are highly detrimental from an economic point of view, massive population growth, terrible stress on the environment, and so forth. But is it really culture in the sense of what the individual people want, or is it the regime which is imposing these? That we don't know from the outside very clearly, I'd say. So I'm not sure, even when it's so cultural, whether it's political fundamentally or whether it's cultural at the core. But for most of the Islamic world, for example, in Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, the role of women has changed tremendously over a 30-year period, with fertility rates coming way, way down, just as in non-Islamic countries, suggesting, hey, maybe it's just the economic development taking place. Maybe there's a big cultural change in those countries. Another thing about culture, I find, is that people invoke culture meaning things that don't change, but religions change, or interpretations of the role of religion in one's life change incredibly. So it's a more complicated phenomenon.
Jody Puri, what about it here? We're right back to culture, geography, and off of Dovey's question, what the West can do to encourage, not discourage, some of the tougher case, the harder cases among the Islamic world's economies to open up?
You know, I'd like to actually, if I can, make a link between something what Dovey said and what Jeff just finished directing our attention to. And that has to do with, you know, you talked about the role of women and the importance of integrating women in the economy. But one of the things that we've seen with the intervention of West-based multinationals, and I think this is where I'm making reference back to Dovey, is that the integration of women in economies is not always an overall positive good, in that women have work under really tough conditions, low-paid work that is often seasonal. It's not, you know, well-paid, or
but
they're not.
But if you don't go that way, half your workforce is not accessible to you, and you're feeding the demographic time bomb, the population explosion, as Jeff Sachs describes it. Jody Puri, what do you do about that?
But precisely, and I think that really raises the important question that in any economic rebuilding plan, we have to think about equity of the distribution of resources, and that includes not only women, but people of the poor socioeconomic groups, which, you know, of which women can be a part of. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of that there is more than one group here that we really need to be thinking about. And I think the real issue has to do with equity of distribution of resources.
Which, as we know, in a number of Middle Eastern countries is highly skewed. We've got a caller right now from Saudi Arabia. Al is on the line. Welcome, Al. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking me.
Good to have you.
I have three comments or questions. The first is the America wants to help. And when we try to reduce the oil production in order to fund our infrastructure, health program.
To raise oil prices, in other words, Al.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The West, the all West, protest against that.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the foreign U.S. aid, third of it, goes to only one country in the region.
Mm-hmm. And that is?
And that is Israel.
Mm-hmm. Egypt gets a pretty good whack of foreign aid as well, don't they?
Egypt is the second, but I mean the third for the foreign aid goes only to Israel, mm-hmm. and if it goes to Yemen, to Libya, mm-hmm. although I know the Libyan political relation is not that good, but I mean for building education, for building health care, not for the government, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Mm-hmm. And your third point, Al?
The third point is regarding the women labor, the Jeffrey Sachs just mentioned.
Yes.
I just would like to mention, to raise one point, that is, we have a 25% unemployment rate of the male or the younger
in Saudi Arabia now.
In Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. who just graduated from university.
Mm-hmm.
So, so
you don't want to compete with women as well.
Yeah, the 25% of our young men who is responsible for...
Got it. Al, we're coming up on a break, and I want to give Jeffrey Sachs a moment to respond. Jeff Sachs, here we are. Al wants higher oil prices. Wouldn't that be good? And what about the rest of it?
Well, I think the idea that he has of investing the oil earnings into human capital, so-called, into education is really a good idea. But it's extremely important that it be invested in girls as well as boys, that the girls grow up to get the skills and participate in the labor market, because Saudi Arabia is in a tough position of having to somehow pull the economy forward with half of the economy not working in the labor market. And that is a very tough road to hoe. And, of course, what happens is that you have these very high population growth rates, which are doing Saudi Arabia no favor. They're going to just add more and more stress in an already ecologically stressed and water-stressed region. So I'm a bit worried about the rapid population growth as well. On the question of foreign aid, I could not agree more that we need to expand U.S. foreign assistance generally. We basically don't have a broad-based foreign assistance program in this country, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about some of the ways that aid could really be effective, because I think that's what people want to know. Could it really work?
We're going to come back after a break and talk about prescriptions for economies across the Islamic world, where and how the West, the U.S., can help. What do you think? Can the West, can the U.S. play a helpful role? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Islamic economies and the lagging indicators that show the trouble there and what might be the way ahead. The question is, what's been the problem? Is it culture? Is it geography? Our guest, Jeffrey Sachs, international development guru, says it's geography way ahead of culture. Do you agree? Do you see hope for an Islamic economic revival? Would you bet your 401k on economic revival in the Mideast? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Will is on the line. Welcome, Will. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say I do agree with Dr. Sachs about the point he's trying to make, and I think something else that hasn't really been touched on mm-hmm. is that, I don't think you can really speak about an Islamic culture or betting your 401k on these economies. What I think you've got to look at is countries that have come out of a colonial experience and see what worked there. And one thing
what worked in what sense, Will?
Well, we've worked in some countries in, like, Taiwan, South Korea.
Uh-huh.
And also another thing that I think is really important that hasn't been touched on is the actual regimes that are in place there. I lived in 10 years in Egypt, mm-hmm. which is essentially an oligarchy, like most of the countries around the Middle East.
And a bit of a plutocracy as well.
Exactly. So they don't really have much of an interest in changing. I mean, they're making their money. They're in control. They mm-hmm. don't necessarily want to liberalize their economies. They mm-hmm. don't want to democratize their processes, which makes people go into underground organizations,
mm-hmm.
Unless you can have a more kind of open. I mean, and touching on the point about women, actually Iran, under the current Islamic regime, has had more women into the workforce than before. In fact, Iran is probably the closest thing we have to a democracy in the Arab-Islamic world in mm-hmm. the Middle East.
Today. Mm.
Today.
Will, good points all, and we'll raise them. We're having a little bit of fun with the 401k. On the other hand, the world is standing and thinking about making a big investment in this part of the world, and we'd like to have some sense of how it may work out. Jeffrey Sachs, what about Will's point, and it's a good one. We have regimes here with people at the top who are doing quite well, thank you. They got their palace along the Red Sea and the nice place in Switzerland, and they don't really want to change. How do your prescriptions of more investment in the populations and closer ties with the West figure when the rulers may not want that path?
Well, of course, it's a big problem. The first thing we have to avoid is viewing these countries as our playthings so that we mm-hmm. keep regimes in power that have no public support. We've done that for our convenience, of course. The 20th century was rife with setting up regimes so that the oil would continue to flow reliably, and it often backfired on us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing is that we have a foreign policy that isn't manipulative of others, but tries to help create a framework in which democratization and economic development can take place. There are many places where it's just beyond our control right now. It's not really us propping up a regime, but a regime propping up itself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in bringing down those regimes for the same reason that I don't think that we ought to be manipulating others. But I do think that economic development, if pursued, tends to lead to democratization also. This is a very, very important general finding. When people are more literate, when they are more urbanized, when they have more money, they fight for their say.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we've seen places like Korea and Taiwan, which were mentioned, become democracies mm-hmm. when they weren't originally.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey is a functioning democracy, one that is constantly in crisis, but it is a functioning democracy. And I think that we ought to nurture that by helping to bring Turkey more centrally into the European economy.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, Turkey's
they've been waiting for their EU membership.
Exactly. The question, will Turkey become a member of the EU, has been viewed rather cynically by a lot in Europe over the last 30 years. I've heard leading politicians of Europe say point blank, Turkey will never get in. It is an Islamic country and we are Christian Europe. And I've heard that view stated publicly by European leaders, which shocks me, actually, because if that's the view, we will create mm-hmm. divides that don't have to happen and should not happen.
Jody Puri, do you see that happening?
Jeff, in some ways, yes. And I wonder, Jeff, if you would speak to the idea about that in some ways that this is an endemic problem in terms of what kind of models are we talking about? If it is a particular model that we associate with the so-called West that then gets, the idea is that's going to get assimilated in various economies
mm-hmm.
which have different patterns, then in some ways isn't that part of the problem?
Can we lay a cookie cutter down across these economies?
Precisely.
I don't think we can lay a cookie cutter, but I do believe that generally countries all face the similar challenge of how to relate to a world economy. And generally, they face the challenge how to be integrated with richer countries in their neighborhood. So if you're a country like Poland, for example, you wonder, how can I trade effectively with Europe?
Mm-hmm.
If you're Morocco, Tunisia, or Turkey, it's exactly the same question for them, or Jordan, or we hope Syria soon, or we hope Egypt, which is we're part of the Mediterranean region. We need to be part of the so-called Mediterranean economic space.
But is there such a thing as an Islamic path and as an Islamic approach to economic development? Might there be? Should there be? Can there be?
I think in general, not. And again, what you see in the course of economic development as measured by the changing role of women in the labor force or higher income levels. You see cultures change no matter whether it's Catholic or Protestant or Hindu or Muslim. You see the role of women rise, for example, the status of women legally and socially rise. That is a cultural struggle virtually mm-hmm. every place in the world, and religions don't bar that from happening.
Jeffrey Sachs, we've only got a minute left. Handicap it for us quickly. If we don't have economic development here, the path looks like one toward more terrorism and even war. What are the odds? How's it going to happen?
The odds are very tough in Central Asia. No one yet has come up with a real strategy for Afghanistan. It's all yak-yak, but no one has a real strategy for how these landlocked countries are going to deal. I'd say the Middle East is very tough also, and the Arab-Israeli conflict absolutely has not only polarized the region politically, but makes economic development difficult. I'd say around the Mediterranean region, the prospects are much better.
And Jody Puri, last thoughts. Can it be done?
You know, I would hope so. And yet I'm still struck by a couple of points. And that has to do with the integration of existing cultural models with international investment. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'm really concerned about is linking population growth, is sort of really targeting population growth as the problem. It might be more a symptom rather than the cause.
Jeff Sachs from Harvard's Center for International Development, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Really a pleasure.
And Jody Puri from Simmons College, thanks for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Tom.
You can continue this conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. In another time, in another war, the battle for the hearts and minds was waged on shortwave radio. Tonight, audio archivist Ned Connors brings us a story of nations at war, Nazi propaganda, and popular music.
Shortly after Hitler came to power in 1933, there was a rumbling that jazz was a corrosive influence on the German soul, that this Semitic and what they called Negro influence was something foreign, something alien to Germany, and was intended to weaken it militarily, spiritually, culturally. By 1935, Goebbels had banned jazz on German radio. And what's interesting is that just a few years later, he gathered some of the best jazz musicians working in Europe and put them under the leadership of a German crooner by the name of Carl Schwedler, who took the American name Charlie. And they formed Charlie and His Orchestra, a propaganda outfit that had no other purpose other than to take American and British popular tunes of the day and tamper with the lyrics so they had a defeatist content. It was part of what is called the Angstkrieg, the psychological war targeted to countries that they were planning to conquer or to influence the home politics of.
Listen to the BBC, BBC, BBC. Listen to the BBC, tra-la-la-la-la. Who's preaching world democracy, democracy, democracy? Who wants to make free people free?
A great example of this is Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, which came out of the Disney cartoon, which is an attack on the BBC, because despite the German efforts to block any kind of international broadcast into Germany, the BBC managed to penetrate pretty well into German airspace. And so they parodied the song Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf to an attack on the BBC.
Bye-bye, Churchill, BBC, BBC, BBC. Your tricks won't work with Italy, tra-la-la-la-la. Why not give us different news, different news, different news? Skip those Soviets, skip those Jews, tra-la-la-la-la.
In 1938, Ella Fitzgerald and Chick Webb Orchestra did a song called FDR Jones. And this was a great opportunity for the German propaganda lyricists to play around. What they did was they played on this notion that Roosevelt was a tool of international Jewry and even played around with the idea that, as was rumored constantly throughout the 1930s that Roosevelt had some Jewish blood. And he was actually approached with a quite open question about that at one point. And Roosevelt just scratched his head and said, I don't know. You know, we've looked into our genealogy, and it would be very nice to find out that we did have some Jewish blood, but I don't seem to.
It's a Hebrew holiday everywhere. For the Jewish family has a brand new heir. He's their joy, heaven sent, and they proudly present Mr. Franklin D. Roosevelt Jones. Non-intervention, how he shows it, his decision to send troops along. Oh, what a jam, and I'll bet he knows it, but he thinks that he can't go wrong. But the folks in the world all agree, he's aggressive, aggressive as he can be. If he could, he'd like to be known to those in history as the big emperor, D. Roosevelt Jones. History,
history. The leader of this propaganda swing orchestra was Carl Schwedler, called Charlie. And although his English is fluent, it has a pronounced German accent, which is a very strange filter through which to hear stuff that's intended to be meaningful propaganda and influence American and British audiences. Perhaps the most bizarre example of this is in a version of St. Louis Blues, W.C. Handy's song of 1914. In this song, an African, British African, I guess, is singing this mournful tune in the context of 65 straight days of German bombing of London that began in September of 1940.
A Negro from the London docks sings the blackout blues. I hate to see the evening sun go down. Hate to see the evening sun go down. Cause the German, he done bombed this town. That Churchill dead man with his wars and things. Pull folks round by his apron string. One for Churchill and his bloody war. I wouldn't feel yet so doggone sore. Got the blackout blues, yeah. Blues.
There was an interview with Adolf Hitler by an American journalist before Hitler came to power. And one of the most salient things about the interview is that he mentions that the only photograph in Hitler's office is a picture of Henry Ford. Now, the influence of Henry Ford is something that's very important because in the 1920s, he published a series of pamphlets called The International Jew, which were culled from the pages of the Dearborn Independent, Ford's notoriously anti-Semitic newspaper in the early 1920s. And that newspaper had explored the issues of the Jewish jazz becoming our national music. It was called the moron music of the Yiddish. And it's entirely possible that the seeds within Germany of seeing jazz as an alien influence came from the United States.
Ned Connors lives in East Providence, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.